This is an oral history with Reynolds G. Birklett, who joined the Outrigger Canoe Club in 1924. The interview is being conducted on August 11, 1987, at the home of Ken Pratt, representing the Outrigger Canoe Club Oral History Committee. Reynolds, before we get into the early days at the Outrigger, could you tell us something of your background?
Well, I was born in Vermilion, South Dakota on October 14, 1910, and came to the islands for the first time in 1911. At that time, my father was a topographic engineer, that is, a map maker, with the U.S. Geological Survey, and he was ordered out here to do some map making on Hawaii. So my mother and my older brother Albert and I came out with him. We camped in tents up near Unkiaho Ranch near Kilauea. We lived in Kamuela and in Hakalau, and also in Hilo, where my brother was born, my brother Dick was born in 1912. In 1913, we went back to Washington, D.C., and then came back again in 1920 when my father was again ordered out here to be in charge of the completion of the mapping of the Hawaiian Islands. I went to school here from 1920 on and went to Central Grammar School and McKinley High School and the University of Hawaii. After graduating from the University of Hawaii with a BA in 1932, I went to work at Castle and Cook as an office boy. I worked at Castle and Cook for 6 years, and then was asked to go to A&B, which I did, and I worked at Alexander and Baldwin until 1959, at which time I quit and went to work with Hawaiian Trust. I worked with Hawaiian Trust until 1975 when I was retired. My first experiences with the Outrigger would have been in 1921, 1922 or so, when I was invited to the club as a guest of neighbors of ours up in Manoa. In those days, the women and the young children used a bathhouse which was on the town side of the club property. As I remembered, it was a long building with shower stalls at one end and then dressing cubicles on either side of an aisle down the center of the building. I don't remember whether we left our clothes in those cubicles or took them out to the beach, but that's where we went when I first dressed and changed clothes when I first went to the Outrigger.
And that would be in the early 20s.
Very early 20s, yes. Uh-huh. And now I think I ought to talk a little about Pop Ford, Alexander Hume Ford.
Well, actually, he was the founder of the club, wasn't he?
That's right, he was. And he's the one who got me into the club.
Isn't that interesting? That's great.
My recollection of Pop was that he was a rather short, slight man with a Van Dyke beard and a mustache, and always in very messy clothes, usually with food stains and spots on his neckties and his trousers. He lived as a bachelor in the castle home at Manoa, and I guess he didn't have anybody to take care of his clothes. But in those days, my picture of Pop generally was riding in his old Model T Ford with a bunch of kids in the car. And somehow, I suppose through our neighbors, we met, my brothers and I met Pop, and we began to be included in his expeditions with all the young boys that he knew. It was through him that I saw many parts of Hawaii that I probably would not have seen for many years after that. I remember that he took us one day out to Hanama Bay. Now that doesn't seem like much of a trip now, but in those days, there was just a dirt road from about where the Kahala Shopping Center is now, all the way out past Wailupi and Neo and Kuli'o'o. And when you got out to the Kuapa Pond area, the road went across the sand dunes there on two wooden planks. And you had to stay on those planks, because if you got off of them, the sand was deep and soft, and you really could have trouble getting out of that stuff. But Pop managed to get us out to Hanama Bay, and he took us down and showed us some petroglyphs down near the water, below where the rifle range is now. Another expedition was up near your place, Kenny. He took us up the old trail to Kapena Falls and showed us the petroglyphs that are carved in the rocks up there in Nuanu.
Oh, my old home.
Your home, yes.
Up in Nuanu. Oh, yes.
There was an old trail up there, and there were quite a few petroglyphs along the trail.
Yes, I've seen those. And they're very interesting.
Of course, we swam in the pool and dived from the rocks. Pop took us up to Francis Gay's place up Kalihi Valley, where to get to the house you had to cross on a bridge over the Kalihi Stream to get in the front door. And we swam there in a pool below the house,
uh-huh.
too. Pop took us out to the Moanalua Gardens, and I remember particularly going down on the Makai side of the road in the area which is now the Mapunapuna Industrial Tract. But in those days, it was a series of fish ponds. And there was one pond that had a little island in the middle of it with a Japanese-style bridge out to it and a little Japanese pergola on the top where you could sit and contemplate the sunset. Then in 1924, my brother Albert and I worked for Pop Ford. As you remember, Pop Ford had all sorts of projects going all the time. And in 1924, he, through his Pan Pacific Union, had organized a food conservation conference, which brought people from all the countries around the Pacific. And during that conference, Albert and I were hired as messengers. Our job was to run between the Pan-Pacific Union office on the second floor of the Young Hotel over to Iolani Palace, where the conference was being held. We carried supplies and messages and ran errands for the delegates, and probably spent maybe 2 weeks on the job. And that was my first job here in Hawaii.
Now, where did Pop have his own office? Do you recall? Was that in the Stanchion Wall building?
No, that was on the second floor of the Young Hotel building, up near the lobby end of the building. Mauka end of the building.
I see.
That's where Pan Pacific Union office. Yeah. That's what he operated out of.
Incidentally, just to get back a second, did you realize that he started the Trail and Mountain Club?
Oh, yes.
Back in 1910, I think.
Yes.
So he'd been doing that a long time when you got in the act.
Yeah, he was a great organizer. He always had more ideas than he could sell.
Yeah, but it was always something people-oriented, wasn't it?
Well, the Pan
Like the Boy Scouts,
yes.
The Pan-Pacific.
Well, the Pan-Pacific Union was intended to bring together all the countries of the Pacific explore common ideas and common needs. Mm-hmm. Well, after working that summer, I had a little money, so I joined the Outrigger Canoe Club in 1924, it was, at Pop's urging. He wanted everybody to belong to the club, of course. And since I was 13 then, I was able to join as a junior member. And I could get a locker in the area of the men's locker room, which was pretty important because then I could leave my bathing suit and leave my towels there. Mm-hmm. And that made me feel like a real full-fledged member of the club.
Remember how much you paid back then?
I have no idea what it cost.
But you were paying it yourself out of your work.
Yeah, you bet.
I
don't think we paid monthly dues. We may have paid them quarterly or semi-annually or something like that.
It wasn't much, I recall.
No. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's very, very interesting. Go ahead.
Right.
Oh, that's right. Wait. Reynolds, back during the 20s, I've forgotten what year it was, your brother Albert had a real bad surfing accident. Could you tell us something about this tragedy?
Yes, that happened in 1925. I wasn't out surfing at the time, but what happened, as I understand it, was that Albert was on a wave sliding left, and somebody came at him sliding right. The waves were pretty big then, and Albert tried to keep from pearl diving. He tried to straighten out and slip to the back of the board to try to keep it from pearl diving, but the wave broke, and the board apparently hit the bottom, and either the wave broke on him, driving him down on the board, or the board jumped back and hit him in the abdomen, and it gave him a very severe blow. Fortunately, there were some friends of his there who saw he was in trouble and got his board for him and helped him get into the club. And when he got ashore, he was really almost paralyzed. So I called my father and asked him got him to come down and pick him up, which he did. He took Albert to see Dr. Judd. That was Dr. James R. Judd.
Oh, yes.
Not Charlie Judd. Dr. James R. Judd, who immediately put him in Queens Hospital and started watching him. They didn't know what had happened to him. But after a day, he started running a temperature, so they opened up his abdomen and found a very unusual sort of thing had happened. Apparently, the intestine had been pushed back against the backbone so hard that it had been perforated.
Oh.
And the intestine had been draining into the body cavity.
Uh-huh.
And peritonitis had set in. I suppose today, with the antibiotics we have and other medicines, he could have recovered from that.
Definitely, definitely.
But in those days, we didn't have those medicines, and I think he lived just 3 days.
That was a shame, because
yes.
He was so young. And
well, it was rather devastating to Pop Ford, because after working during the summer there, Pop had gotten Albert interested in some of the projects that he was working on all the time. And Albert used to go up to Castle Holm and spend afternoons up there working on various things. And Pop became very fond of him. So when Albert was killed surfing, this was quite a blow to Pop. After all, he had been the one who had promoted surfing and founded the club for that purpose and then wanted everyone to surf. And here one of his favorites had been killed in what was probably the first surfing accident to be recorded. So after it happened, he went to the outrigger directors and suggested that they create an honorary membership in honor of Albert, and that they recommended that they give it to my brother Dick, which the club did. So the thing you should ask here, Ken, is how come your brother Dick got the honorary membership instead of you? And the reason for that was some foolishness that I had indulged in a short while before. As I'd said earlier, Pop always had a bunch of kids riding around in the car with him, and often he would let us steer the car as we sat next to him.
Uh-huh.
And then as we got more adept, he'd let some of us drive the car with him, of course, sitting next to us.
Mm-hmm.
The Model T Ford, if you remember, was fairly easy to drive, and a number of us were able to do it.
I got my license driving.
Did you?
You bet your life.
Good for you.
1927.
Well, that's good.
Uh-huh.
Well, on this occasion, we were coming down from Castle Holm to our place. Castle Holm was up above Upper Monoa Road, and we lived down on Lower Monoa. And to get down there, we came down Kuahini Drive, which had a fairly steep angle to it. And as we got down just before the intersection with Lower Monoa, there was another car coming down from the right, down the hill on Monoa Road. to pass in front of us. So I stepped on the brake. And if you remember those Model Ts, their brakes weren't very good either.
Yeah.
The car didn't stop. So then I took the next step, which was to put it in reverse. And I stepped on the reverse pedal, and the car slowed down, but it kept inching forward into the intersection. And just as the other car passed, I nicked the fender. Our fender nicked his. It didn't do any damage to the other car, and nor to Pop's. I don't think there'd been any damage. You could have identified it. His car was so full of bumps and dents anyway. But it upset me. I drove down to our house, which was 100 yards or so below the intersection, parked the car, and got out and ran away. I was embarrassed and chagrined. I didn't want to talk to anybody. I didn't want to talk to Pop about it. I knew there was nothing bad, but I just was disappointed in myself, I guess. So I ran away, and I climbed up in a big ironwood tree in the yard next door and sat up there. While Pop went all through the neighborhood calling for me and calling for me and calling for me. But I didn't come down. So finally he left. And after that, our relations were a little cool.
A bit strained.
It was foolish on my part, but after all, what was I, 14 years old, and I guess maybe that's the sort of thing you do at that age.
Oh, yeah. Those things happen in the early teens. There's no doubt about it.
But actually, the honorary membership worked out pretty well for the club. My brother Dick didn't finish at the university. He left before graduation and went over to Kauai to work for your brother.
This was Dick.
Dick, yeah, to work for Scott at McBride Sugar Company.
Yeah, and you know, Mim, my wife, remembers him up there.
Really?
She went up there with a couple of teachers from Punahou, stayed at Scott's for a day or two. And Dick was the one who showed them all around the plantation.
Oh, be damned. Jack Johnson was up there at the time, too.
She doesn't remember Jack, apparently. But
well, then when your brother went from McBride over to Kohala on the island of Hawaii, he asked Dick to come over with him. So Dick went to work on Hawaii and stayed there until he was called into the Army in 1940. And then after the war, he moved to Arizona for his health and lived in Phoenix until he died. So for most of his life, he wasn't in a position where he could use the club and might not have continued his membership if he had not had an honorary membership.
I see.
Now, on the other hand, I've lived here all my life, and I've paid my dues every month since 1924, I guess it was, since 1924, except for a couple of years during the war when I was away in the Navy. And during the war, that is World War II, I think all of the members who were away in the service were given military leave, and we didn't pay dues again until we got back after the war was over. Well, to go back when I first joined the club, shortly after I became a member, my friend Bob Peterson gave me an old surfboard. It was pretty beat up. It had pearl dived a number of times, so the nose was splintered and the varnish was mostly gone, but it was a great board to learn on. And as I remember, we small kids all learned to surf in an area that was just to the left, the Diamond Head side, of a groin that ran out from the beach out into the water. The groin had been built originally to keep the lagoon discharge from eating into the Moana Hotel's beach sometimes, so that the stream generally ran out right next to the groin, and sand built up on the Moana side, so it was shallow there, and the waves used to break in that area. And we small kids could first start catching waves by pushing off on the board, and then later on learning to paddle and catch the waves by paddling. And we didn't go near the canoe surf for a long time. It must have been probably a year before I even tried to go out there. And I can remember going out a number of times and paddling and paddling and never catching a wave. And particularly, we stayed away from the Beach Boys. They didn't want us small kids in their way when they were surfing, and especially when they had tourists out there surfing tandem with them.
Afraid you'd bump into the tourists.
Oh, well, we'd get in the way.
Oh, yeah.
Which we would have.
Uh-huh.
We'd get our
Remember the little swamp there? Is that where you were used to practice? There was a swamp.
No,
you said there was a stream coming
there
out.
There was a lagoon.
Lagoon, rather.
Between the beach and Kalakaua Avenue.
Yeah.
This is before the canal was built, so the Manoa and Palolo streams, Makiki streams used to discharge big swamp area where there was rice and banana patches and duck ponds, and one of the outlets was right there at the outrigger.
I think that went right under, the stream went right under Kalakaua Avenue.
There was
a little bridge
and it
just
did.
About where the Prince is.
And then there was a lagoon, and then a stream that ran out into the ocean.
Uh-huh.
And I suppose it was that fresh water discharge that kept the coral from growing there in that area.
Ah, yes.
That was all sand.
Probably.
At that point.
Yeah.
Well, the guys that I surfed with finally were able to handle the waves outside, so we began really our real surfing career after a few years there.
Then you went out to canoe surfing.
Canoe surfing.
First break, or didn't you?
Well, we were a little Kanalua first break for a good long while.
How about castles?
Oh, no. I never went to castles.
Uh-huh.
I went out to, later on, went out to kunas and public baths, but never to castles or zero break, which was way out.
Do you remember the article and picture in Believe It or Not, Ripley's Believe It or Not, that had a story about Duke Anamokos going out of... Could you tell us about that?
I remember when that happened. The waves were big, and as I recall it, he caught a wave out at Castles and caught it far enough out so that he was able to slide left through public baths, through kunas, through queen surf, on through canoe surf, and came in practically to the beach on a single wave.
Right in Cornucopia, the small surf there.
Well, he might have ended up in Cornucopia, yes. Yeah, we used to surf in Cornucopia, too, and that was the area right in front of where the Royal is now.
The Duke joined the club about 1917, wasn't it?
Well, he was swimming for the club in those early days, so I presume he had some sort of a membership.
I think he was with Huey Nella when he burst into fame in 1912. But
well, I think Dad
brought him over to the club about 1917.
I think he belonged to both clubs all his life.
Oh, I see. I see.
Huey Nalo kept on going after he was a member of the outrigger.
True.
And he had all his pals over there, and his brothers belonged to Huey Nalo, and I'm sure he continued his membership there, too.
And speaking about Duke and his brothers, do you remember the surfboard water polo that they had? That was the early 30s, wasn't it?
I think so, yes.
Now, we haven't had a story about that I recall. Could you tell us something?
Well, I don't know how it got started, except it was begun as a tourist attraction, I think, by the Royal Hawaiian.
It was right in front of the Royal
Hawaiian. Promoted it. And the teams were made up of Beach Boys and Outrigger members. I remember George Perry used to be the goaltender for the Outrigger. I think Wilfred Paul played, but I don't remember who the other...
I played.
Did you?
On a lot of those, yeah. It was Huey Nalo against the Outrigger Canoe Club.
Right.
And Duke played with Sam
and Louis.
And Louis. Louis played. And you remember Sam pulled a fast one once. In one of the meets, he sharpened the rear end of the board. So he had two front ends of the board. And he would swivel on his stomach if he wanted to change directions.
Well, that was pretty smart, because turning a board around could take time.
I recall the distance between the nets was a little longer than pool.
I imagine. It would have to be if you're going to maneuver a surfboard.
That's right.
But generally, it was played just like regular water polo, as I remember.
That's right.
With a fairly soft ball that you could hold and throw easily.
And it was right in front of the Royal Hawaiian, so that they had all the audience
on the beach.
Sitting on the beach watching, and they used to get good crowds.
That's right. I remember those games. Well, you remember, you mentioned the Royal Hawaiian I remember when the Royal was built, I guess starting in 1926 or 27, and that, of course, part of that, of the Royal property, had been occupied by the outrigger, so the outrigger had to move. And they took the big pavilion that was on the beach and moved that back towards Kalakaua Avenue.
Oh, yes.
And then built the men's and women's locker rooms underneath the pavilion. Mm-hmm. And then they left a parking lot between the pavilion and Kalakaua Avenue. Then on the ocean side of the pavilion, there were two volleyball courts and an open sand place, and then the little soda fountain or candy stand that used to be operated by Sasaki.
Oh, yes.
And then on the beach side, a new shed was built to protect the canoes. And the canoes were stored on the beach. At the Waikiki end of the shed, they paved part of it, or rather put down a wooden flooring so that people could sit there in their chairs. The mothers could watch their children swimming, and people could sit and watch the surf there.
I don't recall that as being very large. Maybe 20 by 20 or
Probably not much more than that.
Yeah. But a very, very comfortable little structure. I remember a lot of us used to sit there and talk story.
Yes, yeah.
Now, you remember in the volleyball, we used to have a competition now and then, and the losers would have to furnish chocolate sundaes at Sasaki's little place.
A double decker.
Yeah.
Two scoops of ice cream with some kind of syrup or sauce on it.
Yeah.
And that was a great prize. Well, those volleyball courts got lots of use. Actually, the one towards the beach was used primarily by the older people, generally for just doubles. The other court was where we kids played mostly when we were small. I can remember frequently Mr. Chase, Chippy Chase.
Yes.
He was a great singles player, and he used to mark off a small court on the big court, and then he'd challenge us to play him in singles. Mm-hmm. He was a tough man to beat.
You bet your life. He would beat the kids any time, the first game. Second game could be either one. A third game, usually the kid would.
he was getting tired. Yeah.
But he could place.
Oh, he was
very excellent.
Tough man to beat.
Yeah.
Another person who played singles with us was Mr. Whittle, the one who founded
Willie Whittle?
His father, the one who founded the Whittle Sign Company.
Oh, I didn't realize.
Skinny little guy, but he swam and he used to work out on the horizontal bar and played volleyball with us. Uh-huh. He was the father of Willie. And Jimmy Whittle and Benny Whittle, they were all good athletes.
All good athletes.
You wouldn't think that they'd stem from a little skinny man like that.
Willie was one of the champion boxers in the
state. He was. He played
state.
He was quarterback of the university football team when I was there.
Uh-huh.
There was a punching bag also rigged near where the men's locker room was, and we were able to get the bag and rig it. I had to stand on a box to punch because I was so short I couldn't reach it otherwise.
Yeah, I remember you punching that bag.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
If you were mad at someone or something, it was good to get your hostilities out.
You bet. And there was also a horizontal bar set up in the sand, and for a while there was a young man named Reed Montgomery who came to the club.
Oh, yes.
Who had been at Westport Military Academy and had been on their gymnastic team.
I remember him. He was excellent.
And he showed us a number of rather rudimentary exercises on the horizontal bar. We used to have a lot of fun doing that. Mm-hmm. We never got really good enough to do a flyaway, for instance, but we had a lot of simple things that we learned from him.
I recall he was, I would say, almost Olympic material. He was excellent.
He was very good. He'd been sick and had to, I don't know whether he went back to the academy, but he had to leave because he'd been ill, and he was out here to recover his health.
Mm-hmm. Norrell's the Royal Hawaiian was completed, and they started bringing tourists out in 1927.
Did the beach scene change quite a bit then, or anything interesting happen in?
Well, of course, it changed the Outrigger considerably because we had to move the pavilion and reconstruct all the buildings. One thing I remember particularly during the construction of the Royal Hawaiian was that they had a great big box on the site there that was just full of bones. They dug up these bones as they were preparing the foundations and threw them all into this big box. And I remember that most people thought that those must be the bones of the soldiers who were killed at Waikiki when Kamehameha landed there with his army. But I don't think that was true. I think the Hawaiians were just smart enough to always bury their dead in a place where it was easy to dig a grave. You find Hawaiian bones on the sand dunes at Mokapu, for instance, and up on Kauai, where they come out of the sand whenever the surf washes over them. And I think they had just buried.